This is The Guardian.
I will end the devastating inflation crisis immediately, bring down interest rates, and lower the cost of energy. We will drill, baby, drill.
We are not ready to give our freedom to this terrorist Putin. That's it.
Trump himself has not changed, and that is the fundamental source of the chaos that threatens his second term.
We're almost halfway through the decisive decade when it comes to fighting the climate crisis. We need unified global action right now to succeed.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
So we're recording this episode, Kieran, on Sunday afternoon because you're going to be jumping on a plane to Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, with Keir Starmer, really quite early on Monday, I think, for the COP29 climate summit.
Yeah, it'll be a 6:30 departure on Monday morning for me from home, going up to Stansted, getting on a plane, spending most of the day on the plane for, in the end, I think what will be kind of less than 24 hours of Keir Starmer's summitry over in Baku. But the good news is I'm told that the weather over in Baku is pretty much exactly the same as here in London, so I won't be missing anything.
You have to pack your winter woolies then. But before we get to that, we have to talk about the still seismic news of Donald Trump winning the US election and what it means for the UK. And this afternoon we had the news from the States that Donald Trump has won in Arizona. Obviously, it takes a few days for the final votes to be counted, which means he's got the full set of seven swing states, which ultimately were going to decide the American election. So, you know, a resounding victory for him, isn't it?
Yeah, he won the popular support and, as you say, every single one of those swing states. So there's certainly no questioning this result. I think very few pollsters actually thought he was going to win the popular vote as well as the Electoral College. But it's almost a relief that he has done, because when you get a result, as happened in 2016, where the popular vote goes one way and the Electoral College goes another, it does feel quite unsatisfying. You know, basically, the majority of American people want one person to be president and the other person gets it. But nope, it's a very clear result. He has won.
So obviously we're going to be spending, well, not just we, but, you know, people right across Westminster will be spending the days, the weeks, probably the months ahead trying to work out what exactly this means for the UK. But I've had a few conversations in recent days with senior Labour figures about what it might mean for the government, and particularly the Labour Party, the fact that the Democrats did so badly at this election, because obviously Labour and the Democrats are seen as being the sister party. And there are lots of different explanations or lots of different theories. Probably several of them stack up and actually were contributing factors. But the one which people keep coming back to in their conversations again and again and again was the economy. Now, we've got used to reporting in recent months about how the US economy, with its high growth and its high employment or low unemployment, was actually a success story. But that feeling didn't really seem to get through to people that were struggling when they went to the supermarket and bought, you know, bread or eggs are the examples that are often cited, because of the high cost of inflation. And it seems to me that the big lesson for Labour is not that they should be talking about, you know, their first mission on the economy was to have the highest growth in the G7, that actually that's a bit ambiguous for people. They don't really understand what that necessarily means. They're more concerned about the economy in how it impacts them, the cost of living, their day-to-day life. And that, for me anyway, the conversations I've had seems to be the sort of overarching lesson that Labour's taking away from the election.
Yeah, which is all well and good, except for the fact that I think, as we've talked about before, the forecast done by the OBR and released at the same time as the budget show this will be the second worst parliament in history for living standards. So it's all fine for Labour's advisers to go out there and brief journalists that, oh, we completely understand and we get it. It's all about the, you know, the price of a chicken in your pot and gas at the forecourt, to use some American cliches. But quite frankly, their current economic forecasts don't show them actually managing to improve that. The only thing I'd say is I think it's easy, and you're starting to see this over the weekend, a lot of Labour people trying to take certain lessons from the Harris campaign. You know, there are quotes. Jess Elgar, our colleague, has done a really good piece tonight where she's quoting one person saying something along the lines of the Harris campaign was a series of celebrities talking about how the opponents were fascists rather than actually what really mattered to people. Maybe, but I also wonder whether this campaign was at all winnable for Kamala Harris because of that inflation that you talked about, which wasn't entirely in, you know, in the gift of the president. I know that probably the US administration, the Biden administration, was a bit slow to realize how permanent this inflation was going to be. But, you know, we all went through these inflation spikes, and almost every government that did, every developed economy that did, has seen the incumbents thrown out. So was this ever winnable for Harris? I'm not sure. Another way to look at this campaign was to stop thinking about the Trump victories as anomalies. I think we get sucked into this idea of, oh, goodness, how did the Democrats manage to fail in 2016 and fail in 2020? Or fail in 2024, I should say. Well, maybe the question is, how did they manage to succeed in 2020 when populism has been on the rise, you know, for decades now? And maybe that was the anomaly because we were going through the pandemic. I remember living and reporting on that election. People were genuinely scared about what was going to happen with this pandemic and how the White House was responding in this very, very erratic way. And Biden seemed like a much safer pair of hands at that time. You can overinterpret from the campaigns. And I just wonder whether the campaign made any difference whatsoever.
Well, I think it was very striking that he won the popular vote. And I don't think the Republicans have done that for about 20 years in US presidential elections. And what people here are talking about that, on the back of that, is that he managed to communicate in a way with ordinary Americans that they need to be able to do with ordinary Brits back here. And that ultimately that comes down to delivery. And yes, for all the reasons you've mentioned, the economic backdrop here is pretty difficult. And people aren't necessarily going to be feeling massively better off in the near future, certainly before the next election. But they feel that the best way, you know, Morgan McSweeney, Keir Starmer's chief of staff, has talked about this in the past, and I know that it's a feeling that's shared by lots of senior ministers, that the best way to tackle the rise of the populist right, which we've seen in the States, we're seeing in France, we've seen in Italy, we've seen in Germany, you know, right across the sort of Western world, is to make sure that you do actually deliver on your promises. And that's very difficult to do when you've got a very jaded and cynical electorate. But this government's best success, best hope of success, is being able to turn around ahead of the next election and say, let's take the NHS, given it's the most obvious example, I think people care about, and say, you know what, actually, you can get a GP appointment and you're not having to wait for months and months for your hip appointment. And the story that Keir Starmer told me, which I think actually speaks to what happened in the States, but also about their view of how they need to run things here, which is, he was talking about a predecessor of his in his Camden constituency, a former MP who was out canvassing and went up to the top of a block of flats. His predecessor knocked on the door and a woman opened it, and his predecessor as MP started talking about world peace and global issues. And this woman who answered the door said, "Did you come up on the lift?" And the MP said, "Well, yes." And the woman who opened the door said, did it smell of wee?" Actually, Starmer used the word piss because he's a bit swearier than, you know, his public image often portrays. Did it smell of piss? And the MP said, "Well, yes." And the woman at the door said, "Well, sort that out before you come here talking to me about global peace." And the lesson from that for Starmer was actually you need to focus on the little things, the small material changes to people's lives in order to show them that you can deliver. And that's the way that you beat right-wing populism. But it's much easier to say than it is to do.
Yeah. And, you know, and people talk about how actually this is the end of that theory of delivery will get you where you need to go politically. And that simply doesn't work anymore. I think the other lesson that the Labour Party, the government, is trying to take at the moment as well, regardless of what happens in a few years' time at any election, is what they need to do now, especially on defence, because we've got this strategic defence review going on that will report back in the spring. I know I've been speaking to people at the Ministry of Defence. That work is really starting to pick up pace. And we're expecting at that point, hoping, I think, that we get some clarity on when exactly and how the government is going to get to that 2.5% target of spending 2.5% of GDP on on defence. And that is going to be a really big moment, right, in US-UK relations, because that's something that Trump has called for again and again and again, for European countries to pull their weight when it comes to defence spending.
Yeah, specifically because the US is a much bigger contributor to NATO, the military alliance, than European nations have been. And we've seen countries like Germany very recently reach the 2%, which is the NATO target. Britain obviously is pushing for that 2.5%. Under the previous government, Rishi Sunak's government, they pledged to hit that by 2030. But that was never a realistic ambition, given all the other financial pressures that the government faced. And so the suggestion now seems to be that this government might push that a few years down the line, and is unlikely to hit it until 2034, which is obviously some way off. But we'll find out more about that in the new year. The most immediate defence issue, which is on the cards and is being discussed in the corridors of power in Whitehall, but also in the Pentagon, frankly, is what happens in Ukraine. And there's been a very clear message from the Trump campaign in the election, although J.D. Vance, Trump's vice president, has gone even further than Trump himself by suggesting that actually they would wind down all U.S. military support for Ukraine. I think the feeling here, and I've spoken to senior officials and senior ministers about this in recent days, the feeling here is that ultimately Trump wants to push for peace, because he's very aware that back home, Americans don't want to be spending the billions and billions of dollars that they're spending on a very far away war that they regard to be Europe's problem, ultimately. But that Trump, as we know, is a deal maker, is transactional. He likes to be a winner. He's got this obsession with being winners. Apparently, that's why he rates Keir Starmer, because he's seen he's won a big election victory here. And he would not want to be on the wrong side of history, looking back where people said Putin won, Trump lost, Trump was weak, Trump is the reason that Ukraine was flattened, and that Putin then was emboldened to push on. So certainly that's kind of sort of like the vibes, if you like, that is coming out at this end. But it's obviously more detailed than that. And ultimately, I think what is most likely to happen, we in the UK think, is that Trump will push. He'll use the threat of winding down military support for Ukraine to get Zelensky round the table and to try and negotiate peace. Because I think what's recognised here is that this conflict is not going to end by Russia pushing on to Kyiv, or indeed by the Ukrainians pushing the Russian military back out of Ukrainian territory. It's going to be resolved around the table. So the first step is really getting people around the table.
Yeah, I was talking to a very experienced Russia hand last week, the day, in fact, after the US election. And they were a strong supporter of Ukraine, and they had a kind of optimistic view, it sounds strange, but the optimistic view was, look, Putin wants too much and won't back down. He will see victory as nothing less than getting rid of Zelensky and regime change in Kyiv. And Trump won't be able to stomach that, because that will look like a defeat for him. And therefore, Trump is likely to push back more heavily than you think. I have to say, having reported on a Trump administration in the past and relations with Russia, there are always people saying, oh, don't worry, Trump's very transactional and he's very rational about how he deals with Russia. And on almost every point, he usually caves. Mm. So yes, Trump likes to be seen as a winner, but what he really likes is Vladimir Putin. And at the end of the day, I just, my gut instinct is that Putin will mainly get what he wants out of Donald Trump.
So it is a moment, it feels like, then, for Europe to basically get its act together, to step up. And the UK is already in conversations with other European nations and with Brussels about having a defence and security pact. It's already done a bilateral deal with Germany, with Berlin, but a much broader one. Not a European NATO or a European army, but I think there's an understanding that, we need to take more of responsibility for what's happening on our own borders as a continent, and that as America sort of recedes from what it is up until this point regarded as its responsibilities in Ukraine, that we need to be able to step up. And obviously the fate of Ukraine and the relationship, the defence relationship between the US and Europe, is going to be a key point for negotiation. And so whoever ends up being our ambassador going forward, Keir Starmer's ambassador in Washington, is going to play a really important role in this. Now, out there at the moment, we have a woman called Karen Pierce, who was around when Trump was last in power. and has proven herself to be a very kind of, you know, plugged in and effective negotiator, and you know, be able to represent Britain's interests. And there's a school of thought that she should be allowed to stay on. Now, her term has already been extended to January so that she can do the immediate transition from the Biden to the Trump administration. But I found out on Friday that Downing Street is keen to press on with their own choice, and that there's a shortlist of three people, and that shortlist includes Peter Mandelson, who we all know well as a, you know, a cabinet minister, former cabinet minister under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, and of course an EU trade commissioner. A woman called Cathy Ashton, who was a senior Labour politician who then went over to Brussels and actually became effectively the EU's first foreign policy chief, was very involved in negotiations with Iran, also with Kosovo and Serbia. And then the third figure is David Miliband, former Labour foreign secretary, who has since led a big international aid organisation in New York, very close to Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. And we had previously, I'm sure we've probably even spoken about it on the podcast, Kieran, we previously thought that if there was a Democrat victory, it's more likely that Labour would have the freedom to make a political appointee, but that if it ended up being Donald Trump, that they might need to stick with a Karen Pierce-style figure, a, you know, effectively a bureaucrat, although she's not very bureaucratic. But that seems now not to be the case, because I was told on Friday that that shortlist of three has been in place for some time, regardless of the outcome of the election.
Yeah, we did know that they were waiting for the outcome of the election before actually making a choice. So there are obviously different calculations depending on who is in the White House. And also, I was texting somebody who had been involved in this decision-making process today, and they were saying, well, look, it's also really important who's in the State Department. And if, as expected, Rick Grenell, the former ambassador, Trump's former ambassador to Berlin, is in the State Department. He is somebody who is known as being very difficult to deal with, very spiky. He was constantly falling out with the Germans when he was in Germany. I would expect him to do the same with pretty much the entire Western world if he is in charge of the State Department. So you need somebody who's got links in with him and can handle that kind of personality. There are competing views on this. There was reporting around on Sunday suggesting that Peter Mandelson is favourite. I am told that he is particularly the choice of Morgan McSweeney. And maybe now that that power battle has been resolved with Sue Gray no longer being there, Morgan McSweeney is freer to make his own choice. Whether or not Peter Mandelson would be successful in Washington controlled with, you know, the White House at the Senate, and it now looks like the House of Representatives all controlled by Republicans, and Republicans really are going to have the whip hand. Whether or not he thrives in that kind of environment, I'm slightly less sure. I've been told the case for Lord Mandelson becoming ambassador goes something like this. He's a real heavyweight political operative. He's very good. He's done it in Brussels before. He's very good at negotiating the corridors of power, and he can suck up to whoever he needs to suck up to get what Britain needs. The case against, I would say, is that he is somebody who can on occasion appear perhaps a little superior and haughty. And he's somebody, obviously, who I think it's fair to say probably enjoys the trappings of office. That's the kind of thing that people in Trumpland tend to hate. They really hate feeling like they're being condescended. And, you know, a posh Brit, that often comes across in America as quite condescending. I think what the government will have to hope, if it is someone like Peter Mandelson, is that the aura of Downton Abbey Bridgerton effect that someone like that can bring with them manages to get them in a way that maybe just a career diplomat wouldn't.
I do think that if guile and flattery and a willingness to put your values and your ideology to one side is a prerequisite for dealing with the Trump administration, I can't think of a better person than the former Prince of Darkness or current Prince of Darkness, Lord Mandelson. But if it is him, or whoever it ends up being, is also going to have to deal very quickly with potential trade war. In fact, Karen Pierce will probably have to start dealing with it, because they want to be prepared ahead of the inauguration in January. And Trump has made clear throughout his campaign that he would impose tariffs of 10 to 20% on all imports to the US and up to 60% on China. So I think we're going to see a real trade war kicking off with Beijing. And there's an indication that it's not just, you know, talking the talk, he's going to walk the walk. He's already said that he's going to reappoint Robert Lighthizer as the US's trade representative, who was around last time he was in power, who's already said that he would want high tariffs on all imports. and you know, has blamed, openly blamed free trade for the loss in domestic manufacturing and some of the economic woes that America has faced over the last 4 years. So I think we should prepare ourselves for a pretty challenging time ahead when it comes to trade.
Yeah. So I mean, look, tariffs tend not to be good, especially for high trade economies like us. I've heard the argument that Britain won't suffer too badly because we tend to trade services rather than goods. But look, we still trade a lot of cars and a lot of whiskey and medicines to America, and those would all be hurt by tariffs. And I know that Rachel Reeves is concerned about that. Rachel Reeves, by the way, is also conscious that there might be an opportunity here, particularly with the, and I think we've talked about this before, if there is to be something of an unwinding of the Biden-era Inflation Reduction Act and the green subsidies that it gave to a lot of green manufacturing, then Britain's actually in quite a good place to try and capture some of that global investment. So tariffs will hurt, and a trade war will definitely hurt. But you know, I know that the government has half an eye on the opportunities as well.
And then there's, of course, how the European Union responds as a bloc to any tariffs that the Trump administration imposes, whether it opts for retaliatory tariffs, as you'd expect it might. And crucially, the question of what Britain does in that situation, because Keir Starmer has talked a lot about having a closer relationship, trading relationship with the European Union, and yet has been very cautious about it for domestic political reasons. And of course, the overwhelming majority of our international trade is with the European Union, compared with a much smaller proportion with the US. So there's a question, I think, arising for the UK about who we decide to side with. But before we get onto all of those really difficult decisions for the government, as we've already mentioned, Kieran, you're jumping on a plane tomorrow morning to head over to the COP29 climate summit, which is where governments are meant to come together to agree on ways to pay for the global climate crisis and sort of underline commitments they've already made to reaching net zero by 2050 and trying to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. But Donald Trump has kind of like thrown a massive spanner into the works on this one, hasn't he? He has said consistently that he believes climate science to be a hoax. He spent much of his campaign saying, drill, baby, we're going to drill, 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 in reference to more exploitation of oil and gas in the United States and presumably beyond. And with global partners already well behind the curve on reaching those net zero targets, this is only going to make things trickier, isn't it?
Look, this whole summit, I think, is not the summit it might have been just a week ago. And it's not just Trump's victory. You know, you've got the collapse of the Scholz government in Germany. So Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, is not going to go. You've got Emmanuel Macron faces his own problems in France. Keir Starmer's almost the only Western leader going who kind of really wants to push through an agenda to tackle climate change. And even he won't be there that long. You know, we arrive in Baku on Monday evening, quite late, and we leave late afternoon the next day. So this is barely 24 hours he's going to spend on the ground there, compared with almost a full week he spent at COP as leader of the opposition. So, you know, I think expectations for this summit are already being set reasonably low. But look, there's a few things that I am looking out for, I think, over the next couple of days. Number one, will we get some kind of loud recommitment by the British government to £11.6 billion? Now, that is the number that Boris Johnson previously committed to international climate finance between, I think I'm getting these years right, 2021 and 2026. The government say they are also committed to that number, but we have already fallen behind where we should be if we're going to hit that target by the end of that five-year period. I am told by Downing Street that they are going to recommit to it, but where are they going to find that money? That's one of the things I'm looking out for. The other thing I'm looking out for is any sense of what we might get, I think, at the next summit in terms of Britain's individual commitments to carbon reduction. That is going to be really important to get to the next stage of carbon emissions reduction worldwide.
And then back here, because there's obviously going to be a few things going on in the UK we need to keep our eyes on. Rachel Reeves is going to be delivering her maiden Mansion House speech, which is the big annual speech given by chancellors. And the government is seeing this as the sort of the next stage after the budget in their messaging around behind going for growth. We obviously, there's very anemic forecasts set out in the Office for Budget Responsibility report, which is published alongside the budget. And since, we've had some analysts suggesting that growth is likely to grow at an even slower rate as a result of all the sort of potential economic turmoil unleashed by Donald Trump winning the US presidential election. So the growth message might be a difficult one to land, but she's going to try. And we're also expecting her to announce that Britain's pension system is going to be overhauled in an effort to increase infrastructure investment by billions. And the Treasury's confirmed reports that pension reform to boost growth will be one of those key messages.
No, that's right. And one of the things that I know Rachel Reeves has been thinking about is whether to force local authorities to combine their pension pots. This is a kind of a reform modelled on what's happened in Canada, where a lot of smaller state authorities have got together and made a much larger pension fund. And the theory being, if you have a larger pension fund, it can take more risks. And the problem is in this country that our pension funds, our institutional investors, tend to be slightly risk averse. Now, multiple chancellors have tried to tackle this problem. George Osborne tried to tackle it by encouraging local authorities to merge their pensions. Jeremy Hunt tried to tackle this problem by setting them quotas to invest in UK stocks. The really big reform would be if Rachel Reeves comes and says, I'm sorry, we've had enough of this. Local authorities are simply going to have to merge their pension funds. That would be quite a major deal, something that previous chancellors have moved towards but never actually taken that decision.
Well, we'll certainly be looking out for it. And you'll be back from Baku, I think, by then, won't you? As you said, it's a flying visit. But good luck on the trip and make sure you pack your thermals. And that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer, for the last time before she goes off on maternity leave, good luck to you, Maz, is Maz Ebtahash. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hi there, Jonathan Friedland here, columnist at The Guardian and host of our Politics Weekly America podcast. I want to ask for your help. Guardian podcasts depend on the support of you, our listeners, to help fund coverage, especially in years like this one. We don't have a billionaire owner or shareholders holding the purse strings, which is how we stay independent. To support The Guardian, just click the link in the episode description. And once again, thank you.
This is The Guardian.